Where are you guys from?
From Holland, Limburg. Yeah, we are supporters from Dumoulin.
How long have you been here?
That's the first day, but we've arrived in this morning, and we've gone after the final of Ajax yesterday.
Ah, it's a bad day yesterday, good day today.
I think 30 minutes after the final was gone with the wind, we went to, it's exhausting. But it was great, it was great. Tommy did great for today.
Have you only got one song or have you got several?
We have more.
Let's hear some of them.
We lost Nibali. We lost Nibali. We lost Nibali.
We are listening to the cycling podcast at the Giro d'Italia in association with Rafa. Today we are in Ortisane.
Cozze ci tene, cozze, cozze vicine. Non spigudeci cora, cozze ci tene, cozze, cozze vicine. Non spigudeci cora, se non mangiano le femmine.
Hello, my name is Richard Moore. I'm with Daniel Freib.
Hello, Richard.
And for the second night in a row, Daniel played in with a bit of singing.
Yeah, serenaded once again. Very, very different though, wasn't it?
Very Dutch.
Very raucous.
Yeah.
Very similar to something we played last year. Our recording abilities have got slightly better. I think last year I didn't record the chorus of Stephen Kryswick chants particularly well, but that was slightly better. I think I'm improving.
You're getting better. You're getting better. We're improving you technically all the time, but... They were interesting Dutch fans. So they'd been at the cup final,
that's
the football,
what
the
I
night
understood.
Before.
Yeah, they were the Ajax Man United game, which was where was it? Where was it?
Somewhere in Scandinavia, was it not?
Oh, okay.
I think. But anyway, the interesting thing about them is that they're obviously following their Dutch heroes around the world. Remind me in that sense a bit of Irish sports fans who do, you know, tend to support Irish sports people. And it doesn't seem to matter. What sport? I remember, you know, back in the 80s, there was huge Irish support for Stephen Roach.
As long as there's alcohol involved.
Daniel, don't What's stereotype. True?
I'm not talking about the Irish, I'm talking about the Dutch now. I mean, that seems
well,
to
you're
be the
stereotyping
case.
Them, is that
no,
okay?
I'm talking about the Dutch fans that we tend to meet at these races. They're young chaps, you know, they're in the primes of their lives, Richard, and they're enjoying themselves, and I condone it, I endorse it. You know, well done, keep coming. Anyway.
Okay, great stage. We're going to talk about the cycling in a moment. Fantastic stage today. Short, snappy, explosive. 137 kilometres finished here in Ortisane. Is that right pronunciation?
Ortisane, yeah.
Ortisane.
You can also call it. Five. Give it its German name as well. St. Ulrich.
St. Ulrich.
But the language spoken here is very odd.
Well, we were coming out over the climb, and on one side of the mountain.
On the Passo Cella, yeah, it's predominantly, well, it's all Italian, and then on the other side it's German. But here, Rich, it's not even German. It's more, I think, more people speak kind of Ladin dialect. Mm. Ladin being an ancient language spoken in parts of the Dolomites and the mountains up here in the northeast of Italy.
Well, the climbing started more or less straight away from the start up the Passo Pordoi. We drove a little bit up there. Spectacular landscape here. We're right in the heart of the Dolomites, and it was absolutely beautiful. Big group went away, included a lot of riders, a few Team Sky, Diego Rosa, Phil Dagenham was there. TJ Van Garderen was there. We'll hear about him again. Joey Roscoff, his BMC teammate, was there. Joe Dombrowski, friend of the podcast, was there. Mikael Landa was there, King of the Mountains. Jan Hurt, we've seen quite a lot of him. CCC, Sprandi, Polkovici was there. It's a big group. Jasper Stuyven was there, surprisingly. But the race really exploded into life on the Gardena when Quintana attacked quite close to the top. Still 54 kilometres to race at that point. He had a few men up the road. Quickly joined up with Andre Amador, and the winner Anacona was there to help as well. Nibali didn't want to miss out on that, and he jumped across as well. Got a bit of help from Dario Cataldo, who'd been in the group, a former teammate of his at Astana. He's still at Astana. Nibali, of course, at Bahrain. Dumoulin at this point was isolated and it was beginning to look a little bit dangerous for him. He'd lost Laurens ten Dam, his final teammate, on the Gardena. And yeah, he looked isolated, but he didn't panic. Typically, characteristically, he just tapped out his steady rhythm and closed it down. And by the top, they were pretty much all together again. Up front, eventually, TJ Van Garderen and Mikael Landa went clear on a descent. In fact, left that group behind. It was now down to quite a few riders. Dombrowski was still there, though. Really, not an awful lot else happened in terms of the overall between those big three of Nibali, Quintana, and Dumoulin. If anything, it was Dumoulin who looked the strongest in the closing stages, by which point Thibaut Pinot had escaped. Hang on, I'm still doing the tail of the crappy. Stop interrupting, Daniel. Thibaut Pinot had gone clear, and you know, he's still a danger overall. He did himself no harm whatsoever today. He's up to fourth overall. Well, he was fourth anyway, but he's closed the gap, gained a minute back today, and finished third on the stage. Then the stage was deja vu for Mikael Landa, who once again got it all wrong and let TJ Van Garderen, didn't fancy Van Garderen's chances at all in that finish. But it was a tricky technical finish, a cobbled road with a gutter running down the middle of it, narrow, and Van Garderen somehow got around Landa and up the inside and took his win. Very, very emotional after he crossed the line. He was crying, heaving, you know, that obviously meant a lot to him. The other great interest today was the white jersey competition. Three contenders for that, Bob Jungels, Adam Yates, and Davide Formolo. Those three sit 9th, 10th, and 11th on GC at the moment, and they're separated by just 53 seconds. Yates, who got great help today from his team, leapfrogged Jungels, who lost quite a bit of time. And Jungels down to 10th, Adam Yates up to 9th overall, and he is in the white jersey. What were you going to say, Daniel?
I can't even remember now. Am I allowed to talk now? Is it over?
Yep.
I was going to say, Rich, there was a volley of attacks in the finale from, well, Tom Dumoulin attacked. Briefly,
yeah, he did, yeah.
Twice, actually.
Yep.
And then he, Nibali, and Quintana started sort of watching each other. Dumoulin was doing his now famous circular, just sort of stirring gesture, suggesting that the other two should have been working. And if they all worked together, then they would reel Pino back in and Pozzovivo back in, and Zakarin also escaped in the end. Quintana and Nibali didn't fancy it, and we're going to talk about whether they should have worked with him. But first, I think we want to talk about Van Garderen, who about 10 days ago, or not even 10 days ago, a week ago, looked a broken man, a broken rider.
He did. A lot happened after the stage as well in terms of words spoken, threats made,
and beef.
We'll get onto that in part two. Let's talk about Van Garderen, because sometimes we don't give the stage winner enough airtime, as it were. But Van Garderen, it's a great story. He was, as I say, emotional. It meant a lot to him. And I spoke to his teammate Joey Roscoff, who'd been in that break as well at the finish, and it was interesting because he clearly has lived that last week or so with Van Garderen, knows him very well, and here's what he had to say at the finish. The result, obviously, what will that mean to TJ?
I'm super happy for TJ. I think he'll. It comes at a great time, the win does for him. Yeah, I mean, I think he's, well, everyone's asking him and everyone's looking for answers about why he isn't up there on GC. I know that's been a really frustrating time for him. But I mean, it's just bike racing. You can't always be good. And today he was good. And sometimes you have to get more creative. If you're not the strongest guy in the race, then you have to get creative and try to win a different way. I haven't seen him yet. I'm about to go to the bus, but I imagine it's a huge relief for him.
He was very emotional after crossing the line.
Yeah, like I said, I think it just takes a weight off his shoulders. I mean, it's a day when he can be the best for once, you know? No, he can... Hopefully he can go a day without people asking him what's wrong.
And you played your part as well today?
Yeah, I went into break from the start. Hung in there till the third climb, I guess it was. Tough day. Not too many flat sections for me to really put in a lot of work, but try to do what I could.
The last couple of days that we've seen TJ in the break, and he's got his reward today. Has he been very determined to, I guess, salvage something from the Giro?
Yeah, I mean, he's a climber. This is his terrain, so it's like we're not here just to finish the Giro. We want to get some more racing out of it, and he's one of the only guys on the team capable of going for a stage win when we're in these high mountains, and so he's taking his chances.
So that was Joey Roscoff. Not bittersweet, but there is a certain defensiveness about the team and TJ Van Garderen, because he has obviously always had this great promise. He was the next great American stage race rider and hasn't delivered on that. And stage win here will be nice consolation, and perhaps it will figure in his thoughts and plans as he decides what sort of rider he is going to be over the next few years, because he's going to move on from BMC where he's on a huge contract, and this was probably a very important result for him in terms of bargaining power.
Well, it was, and as I said, he looked forlorn and defeated a few days ago. I understand that about two or three days ago, after the stage to Bergamo, where he went pretty well, his demeanour sort of changed. In fact, let's hear about how it changed and why it changed from Marco Pinotti, who's one of the direct sportifs at BMC.
So Marco, already in the last two or three days, do you think TJ has been a bit of a changed character? He seems to be in a much better mood and he seems to have got confidence again.
Yeah, I think from Bergamo stage, he got the confidence back. In Bergamo, he was able to, in a hard day, to be in the lead group to help Herman. So he kind of switched a little bit role from feeling depression, having performed GC, into a more freedom. And day after day, was his body language was telling us that he was getting better. And performance-wise, he was also improving. Yesterday, he was in the break of the day, in a hard day, and he got his confidence back even more. And today, we didn't actually surprise a lot of people, an exceptional ride.
But sometimes in this year, it's almost been hard to watch him from a distance, that he's looked as though he's put so much pressure on himself and he's really not been enjoying himself.
Yeah, that's the impression that from the outside you have looking at him. And probably once he was free from this pressure, he was able to, the team was kept supporting him. He knew that he had the form, and he showed this yesterday. He knew from Romandy that form doesn't disappear in 2 weeks. I think this is a good lesson. It's a step forward for the rider. We discussed this morning that you do the meeting, you run the meeting this morning, because he's been doing training camps here at least 2 years. One was before Tour 2014. So he knew the area. He's been, he's probably did you saw in the race that he was sometimes leading the downhill. He did downhill that he did maybe 20 or more times. So he was feeling at home, in my opinion. That also contributed as well to his performance, I believe.
So, Rich, interesting there, Marco Pinotti talking about TJ Van Garderen's local knowledge. He spent a lot of time. There's kind of a bit of flat road between the Sella and the Gardena. And I understand that there's a hotel there that TJ Van Garderen has spent a lot of time
in. Yeah, he talked about it.
He did in the press conference.
Yeah.
Okay. And that probably helped him, or Pinotti certainly thought it helped him. And
he said he knew every inch of road around here, Van Garderen.
Yeah, and he obviously, as Marco said, he felt at home. Interesting. Marco said there that, he thinks this will relaunch or could relaunch Van Garderen's career. It might teach him to dig in. I think there's been a few noises, suspicions that Van Garderen's problem perhaps has been that his head can drop. I mean, no one doubts his physiological abilities. I had a long conversation the other day with Bram Tankink of Lotto NL Jumbo, and he was talking about the way BMC ride, and he talks about the kind of the stress that not just TJ Van Garderen, but other leaders in that team tend to exude, because they're always desperate to ride together in a clump of riders. And I think this is something that probably originated with, or you can trace back to Cadel Evans' time at BMC, when he was very successful a couple of times with this tactic, notably when he won the Tour de France. And since then, supposedly Van Garderen, and whether it's been kind of inculcated or whether it's something that he is dictating himself, but he's always desperate to be surrounded by teammates. You know, Bram Tankink said that whenever you see Manuel Quintiato on a flat stage, you always know that the next rider is going to be TJ Van Garderen. But Van Garderen is often fighting very, you know, he's really battling to stay on Quintiato's wheel, and that obviously creates a lot of stress. And you know, if he's also suffering from kind of the mental stress of expectation and, you know, imagining what people are saying about him, which is certainly, he suggested that a few days ago. So and it's all probably added up, or perhaps added up to a bit of a sort of pressure cooker atmosphere. And for whatever reason, he managed to release some of that pressure a few days ago, and I think just showed what he is capable of, because as a physiological specimen, he's impressive.
2 days in the break, and you know what was impressive about the way he finished that off was that he doesn't have much practice at that, really. You know, and you come to that moment in the race where it must be nervous, and you're up against a rider, Mikel Landa, who has won more races and should have a bit more of a killer instinct, although he's messed up a couple of finishes, but you know, he did it very well, and you know, he obviously enjoyed his stage. It's interesting what you say. We were talking about this phenomenon of teams riding together. It looks great on TV, and you can see, you know, teams clumped together. A lot of them do it now, and they're all sort of fighting to be as close to the front as possible. This pushes the pace up. I was speaking to Charlie Wagelius about this as well, about what that does to the speed. We saw an example of how dangerous it can be on the stage to Blockhouse when, you know, Team Sky came into this race with two leaders. They were both more or less together on the same bit of the road when they hit the police motorbike. And so had they been placed in separate parts of the bunch, they might not have lost both their leaders, which they did. Now, Landa is somebody who does freelance a little bit, and speaking to people at Team Sky, he apparently wasn't exactly there and had a more of a floating role, if you like. But the fact is, he was there at the time, and they were both caught up in that crash. And of course, that just threw Team Sky's game plan out the window. We saw it back in 2012 in the Tour de France when Garmin lost their whole team because they were all together when there was a huge crash. So there are risks attached to that tactic as well. Speaking of Team Sky, I spoke to Phil Dagenham at the finish. He was in the break again today. He's been in a lot of breaks this week, obviously to help Mikel Landa, who is pretty safe, it looks, in the mountains jersey. But, yeah, here's Phil Dagenham. Obviously, the Giro hasn't turned out how the team wanted, but are you enjoying the bit of freedom that you're getting?
Well, yeah, I suppose we just had to totally change. Obviously, we came here for GC, but enjoy is probably the wrong word. It's different to what I'm used to, but, it's just all about really having the legs, trying to get up, and then also we always have the objective with Mikel, you know, with Landa for the mountains jersey and stage wins. He's been close now a couple of times, but it's been good.
What's it like to come in with such a clear focus and have that taken away? How long does it take to readjust?
It probably took a few days, you know, like. We just identified it a few stages this last week and identified the mountains jersey to sort of prioritise, and we went all in, on the Stelvio day as well, you know. So that sort of kept us switched on really and motivated. So
we don't know how Geraint would have got on, obviously, but Mikel has looked very, very strong. I mean, do you, in terms of how, watching him climb and watching him go close in these stages, do you wonder what might have been?
Yeah, of course, you know, it's always the case. You know, it's like I've seen how hard he worked, you know, up in Tenerife, and he got here in the shape to try and go for the GC, so, and the same with Miguel, so I was just devastated for them, really, you know, all the hard work they put in, and just in one moment could be taken away, so, but that's cycling, eh?
Hello, I'm Stefano, I'm a barista at Rafa. I'm from a small town, which is in between Modena and Bologna. The rule is no cappuccino after 11, please. In the afternoon, you can always have like espresso, something really popular in Italy, which is the corretto. I don't know if you've ever heard the corretto. It's like a single shot of espresso with a drop of Sambuca. And, you know, it makes more sense in the afternoon, even in the night. Yeah, absolutely. Rafa Cycle Club are some of the best equipment, best baristas. Sometimes you can find me as well, so.
The Rafa Cycling Club is the largest global community of its kind. Members share their passion for the road through rides, events, exclusive club kit and racing. Find out more at rafa.cc.
Thank you very much indeed to our wonderful sponsors, Rafa. We heard there, again, I said last night we were going to try and play a different Rafa clip. We play sort of riders sponsored by Rafa or staff members every night, and we're going to try and do a different one every show this year, although this one that you've heard tonight is a doubler. Stefano, the wonderful barista at Rafa. Since we're at the Giro, I thought we'd hear from him again. Great guy. And I should say that our final Pedlar de Charme award of this Giro will be made this weekend. The shortlist has been compiled. The votes are open. The shortlist
Isn't it Tom Dumoulin?
Pippo Pozzato.
It's Tom Dumoulin who... The vote's been open about half an hour and he has got 46% of the vote so far. Tom Dumoulin, Pierre Roland... Mikel Landa is doing pretty well, and Filippo Pozzato is there as well. But
one well-known, well-used website was sixth on general classification tonight. I think they might have confused him with Domenico Pozzovivo, unfortunately.
There's a Twitter poll running. Get your votes in, and we will present the winner with a wonderful, lovely Rafa-made and designed Pedlar de Charme T-shirt over the weekend at some point. We should remind you, I think we've said it already, but the Rafa are launching a range of cycling podcast clothing next month, so that'll be available in time for the Tour de France. We'll keep you posted on when that's going to be available. So the GC battle today...
We're talking a lot about cycling now, aren't we?
Yeah.
Yeah, this last few days since you came, we've been talking a lot about cycling. I've noticed this.
I'm a bit one-dimensional like that.
Anyway, so we're going to talk about cycling in this part?
Yeah.
Okay.
Tom Dumoulin. Well,
maybe in the last part we'll talk about other stuff.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Okay. But Tom Dumoulin, you know, a few verbal volleys at the finish. There was footage of Dumoulin and Quintana. Obviously, there were words exchanged during the stage when Dumoulin was keen for Quintana and Nibali to help him or to ride together to close the gap on Pino Zakarin and so on. And they didn't. And Dumoulin carried on that conversation afterwards. Quintana's body language was stone cold. I mean,
it's always stone cold,
yeah,
isn't it?
Yeah, he's not an expressive guy at all, but he just gave him pretty short shrift. There's obviously a language barrier there as well. But and then some pretty harsh words were spoken by Dumoulin. He said initially on Eurosport that he hoped... by the way they rode, that Quintana and Nibali would lose their podium positions in Milan. And it wasn't just something said casually or in the heat of the moment, because he then repeated that in every interview that he gave subsequently in the mix zone. Then he came into the press conference and said, you know, by which point, and this is the way things work, by which point his comments had been put to Nibali and Nibali had responded
and also translated, yeah, maybe slightly loosely.
Yeah. Which all adds
which
to
always
the,
happens. I mean, I was in the
fun, doesn't
well,
it?
I was in the Dumoulin press conference, and I'm not going to say there was some of that going on, but you know, language is such a complex thing, and even if your translation is such a complex art, and a slightly different nuance can give rise to a completely different response, and then that can give rise to a completely different response from the other guy who it's targeting. So there is a bit of that going on, definitely.
Yeah, it's nice to see a bit of needle, but we shouldn't mistake it for outright animosity. I mean,
well, not yet.
Not yet. But Dumoulin was asked, you know, was told that Nibali had said, well, you know, karma might strike, and, you know, Dumoulin speaks too much, and blah, blah, blah. And Dumoulin's response to that was, and he calls me cocky, which was obviously said with a bit of humour. But there were one or two things he said in the press conference which I noted down. He was asked, did you expect a strong attack from Quintana and Nibali? And he said, well, I think it was a strong attack. The inference being that he was also pretty strong to be able to close it down. And then he was asked about the tactics that Movistar deployed, and you know, talk about damning with faint praise, said he thought it was a very good tactic. It's like, surprised he didn't pat him up, pat Quintana on the head as he coughed him up.
Yeah, I mean, the one thing I disagreed with, which Dumoulin said, was that, well, the whole idea that Quintana and Nibali should have worked with him in the finale to reel in Pinot and Pozzovivo. I mean, these are two guys who have got a significant palmarès already. You know, they don't need a second or third place in the Giro is not going to change anything for them, and they're here to win. What surprises me, and I think what the point really is why was he, or why have they been doing any work, or their team's been doing any work for him when he's been isolated earlier in stages and was isolated earlier in today's stage? You know, he's had to do so little work, and there are various reasons for that. And you know, we talked a lot in the first week or so, 10 days, about how many contenders there were in this year and how many GC riders. What that also meant was there were so many interests, and there are still a lot of riders in contention for something good, whether it's a podium position, whether it's a top five, top 10, or the white jersey, which I think is going to be significant. And what that means is that there's always someone to pull. There is always someone who, you know, when Movistar go down the road, have an interest in pulling, and consequently Dumoulin can really ride around on this, float around on this sort of magic carpet. It doesn't matter to him that he doesn't have teammates, and it's all working out in his favour, and they've got to be very careful. I mean, the only way to change this would be if there was a real alliance, and the Zakarin, Pino, Quintana and Nibali got together and they said, look, we're going to give ourselves each 25% chance of winning this race. One of us is going to win it, but the other three are not going to chase. If Nibali attacks, the other three of us are not going to chase. And eventually, of course, Dumoulin would crack then.
Might there be a pact between Nibali and Quintana? He sort of hinted that they were working together.
I think unless something's changed, I mean, who knows how these things might work. I mean, maybe an intermediary, for example, might be Perito Rodriguez has arrived on the race the last couple of days. I spoke to him at the finish, actually. He, of course, used to ride for what is now Movistar. He's now working for Bahrain Merida as a sort of consultant. He's kind of giving Nibali some advice. Who knows that he might open the channels of communication between them, but that is almost, I think, what needs to happen. Certainly if Dumoulin stays as strong as he is, and also we talked yesterday about the number of friends that it seems Dumoulin has in the peloton, and you know, I wondered whether I'd got that right, and you know, that's just the way it looks from the outside. But I did talk to a few people about that today, this idea that, you know, Movistar are a bit of an island and they're a bit isolated, partly by virtue of language. And Dumoulin is a very popular figure, and most people sort of confirm that to me today. So, you know, so many interesting sort of politics are playing out.
The white jersey competition is certainly something that seems to be working in Dumoulin's favour. Orica Scott did a good job for him today. Even at times Movistar, you know, I wondered what their game plan was. They've got so many strong riders, and you know, at one point they sent Wiener Anacona up the road on his own, then Quintana bridged across, and it was all a bit obvious, and Dumoulin is strong enough that that's not going to really, really bother him. I think you're right, though, that in that situation where Zakarin and Pino are riding away, the onus there is on the guy in the pink jersey to actually chase that down, not the others. That's the point. I mean, they're not his allies in that situation at all.
Rich, we talked the other day, or people talked about the privileges that come with the pink jersey, including the privilege of the group stopping to when he needs to go to the bathroom, when he needs to relieve himself. There are privileges with having the pink jersey, but there are also responsibilities and there are also obligations. And historically, according to cycling folklore, in terms of the hierarchy of who pulls first, the pink jersey is always right at the top. He should always be the first guy to have to pull, or his team. So, you know, Dumoulin can't really have it both ways, can he?
No. And what should be happening is these guys should be attacking him one by one, and really forcing him to chase them down every time. That's what should really be happening, because, you know, ideally he has a teammate there that does that chasing for him, but he doesn't. And they should be taking advantage of that, and they're not.
Yeah, and just as regards the tactics, you know, Movistar, it's kind of predictable, and we've seen it again and again with Amador and Anacona going down the road. But is there really an alternative? I mean, I asked Perito Rodriguez about that tonight, and he said, well, Not really, and also we should only really judge whether the tactic has worked on the evening of the last mountain stage, because you know, he said you can't judge it until the last mountain stage, because that's when it might really tell. It might be that that's when the elastic snaps and all the work that Movistar have done in previous days then comes to fruition. But you know, the problem they're having at the moment is that Anacona and Amador are going down the road, but and they're getting into brakes, but they're having to pull in those brakes, and by the time that Quintana bridges to them, they're spent. They're completely spent. I mean, just on this idea or this theme of how important teammates can be in these big mountain stages, Konstantin Siutsu, one of Nibali's key domestiques, who tried to sort of set him up today with a similar bridge tactic that Movistar used. He was in the break early. He earlier in the Giro was a turkey voting for Christmas, because he basically told me that domestiques are useless in the mountains. And I asked him tonight how he judged Movistar's tactics and whether he still agreed that really Gregari or domestiques weren't of much help.
Anyway, if you not have team, you need just follow two or three guys. And anyway, we are in the last week in the stage. Normally during the one day you do three races, one for the winner in the stage, one for general bottle, and second it was for the top 10. It was everyone is start looking each one. It was like this.
You are listening to the cycling podcast at the Giro d'Italia, supported by Science in Sport. Science in Sport, fueled by science.
Thank you very much indeed to Science in Sport, who sponsored the cycling podcast throughout 2017. Reminder, you can get 20% off all your Science Support products at sciencesupport.com. Enter the code CPOD20, CPOD20. Last night we heard a contamination feature, about little mini feature about contamination and how Science Support avoid their products being contaminated. I should have said that one of the voices we heard there was Stephen Moon, who is a great supporter of the Cycling Podcast. He's chief executive at Science Support, but meant to say it last night. Thanks, Stephen, for your support of the Cycling Podcast in social media and so on. It's very much appreciated. Well, Daniel, we want
to talk about other things.
Oh, no,
we want to talk about other subjects.
You stuck your hand up there to say something.
Should we talk about scenery?
Yeah.
Should we talk about how beautiful the Dolomites are?
Yeah, they are beautiful.
I mean, I did say today on Twitter, probably an ill-judged comparison, that the Pordoi and the Sella are kind of like sisters, and it's a bit like the Minogue sisters, and you know, you go... For a long time, here I preferred Kylie, and then now I think I'm sort of, I don't know. And I kind of thought this about the Sella today, because for a long time I've been a big sort of advocate and champion of the Pordoi. It's one of the great Dolomite passes. It's got fantastic history. The Giro's been over the Pordoi much more often. Fausto Coppi went over it first, I think, five times. And the Sella is sort of the forgotten sister. But today,
it's a good copy story about where we are now. Giro first came here in 1940, and it was one of the great sort of Gino Bartoli, Fausto Coppi stories. 1940. Daniel, you were telling me about this earlier.
I don't know. Did the stage finish in Ortizé?
It finished in Ortizé. It's only twice before. 1940.
Well, they were riding as teammates, weren't they?
2005, when Ivan Parra won. They were riding as teammates
at
the time.
And one of them was it. Bartoli went the wrong way. Or Coppi went the wrong way, and by the time they got back together again, Coppi was fading badly.
Bartoli was in pink,
and Bartoli had to put
Coppi was in pink,
And Bartoli had to put snow down Coppi's neck
to keep him hydrated.
To keep him hydrated,
and Bartoli won the
hydrated.
Stage.
Hydrated,
yeah.
I think cool him down.
All
no?
right, okay. I don't
anyway,
know.
Anyway,
bit of cycling history there for you.
A bit of cycling history, but talking about you know.
But you know this area very well, Daniel.
I do. Well, relatively well. Not that well, Rich.
You holiday here with T.G. Van Garderen.
No, I didn't. Anyway, talking about you know techniques to keep to revive riders and keep them performing at their best, we're going to have to talk again for the third night in a row about the things that I don't like talking about. Tom Dumoulin's problems a couple of days ago en route to Bormio.
What was that again?
Well, you know, I think you know what it was, Richard. Anyway, tonight at the finish, I spotted the Sunweb doctor, Anko Berlunds, And in the last 24 hours or so, the noises coming from Sunweb have been that they still didn't know quite what happened. They had a good idea. Anyway, I decided to check with Anko Berlens whether they had any more clarity today on what exactly had happened to Dumoulin on the road to Bormio.
When somebody has a sudden bout of diarrhea, you fear that he's getting sick. So that might have been the question that's in the back of your head yesterday. But immediately we thought this is probably a reaction to high intensity and one gel or something too many, which gave a reaction. And we try to plan it as well as possible. Eh? We in advance we try to calculate how many calories is a rider of us going to need. So we have a tactic, take this at that moment, etc. But yeah, things happen during a race. Sometimes you cannot really take it at the moment you want to. And then the combination, yeah, it happened. But already on the same day, the way he felt after, we were pretty confident already that this was not going to be a major long-term problem. And obviously the day after, during the race, that's the real test. But after today, after yesterday, after the finish, we already felt okay. This is a done deal. This was a case of bad luck and perhaps a little bit sensitive bowels. But that's perhaps we even more than before. We really feel like okay. We need to do it to do the most perfect schedule. Eh? We try to follow it as best as can. And because it's still only 2 days after, we made small changes in stuff that is really hard to digest, but that is really, really minor. In general, he still uses the same products. He still eats gels. he doesn't have a phobia for gels at the moment. So, yeah, it's okay. It's today was good, and it's behind us now.
So we heard there from the team Sunweb doctor. I actually had a text message today from Nigel Mitchell, the nutritionist at Cannondale, formerly at Team Sky. We heard from Nigel on this very topic previously. I had a text message today. Your sidekick is talking bleep about sugar and the toilet. Too much sugar can cause osmotic diarrhea, basically.
I didn't think I gave my own opinion.
Well, he was saying that your argument that too much sugar might cause it, which,
definitely wasn't an argument.
Chad Hager said the same.
It definitely was an argument because I know nothing about this fridge.
No,
so
okay.
I said, I think I paraphrased an expert. I can't remember who the expert
usually,
was. But
usually a safe enough thing to do.
Yeah.
Anyway, white jersey, Daniel, this is shaping up nicely. I mean, Bob Jungels did lose a bit of time today. Adam Yates is now in the white jersey. But Jungels, of course, is the big threat going into the final time trial in Milan. If you look at the overall, I mean, Jungels is 28 seconds down on Yates with Formolo still up there as well. But the trajectory today, I spoke to Ruben Plaza at the end, who did a hell of a work, a lot of work today for Yates. And I found myself, it's a different scenario, but we wonder a lot about Movistar's tactics. And one guy whose tactics seem to invariably work, Matt White at Orica. And what they did today, to lose Jungels and to put Formula under pressure, was, okay, it's happening, it's a race within a race rather than the race itself, but it worked a treat. And Yates, who had that mishap on the road to Blockhouse, he was caught up in the crash, well, lost a lot of time, is now in the top 10 overall and, you know, in the white jersey.
Yeah, I mean, I think one thing that Orica really do is commit, and they choose their days very carefully. You know, what we tend to see with Movistar is that in every mountain stage, they try to go for the jugular, and not only at this Giro, but in Grand Tours in general. And, you know, maybe that's the big difference between them and Orica. Orica pick their moments, but when they do go, they really go. It's going to be interesting. I think that Yates is probably the favourite now for the white jersey. It's good to see that competition being so keenly contested. I mean, sometimes it feels a bit like an afterthought. Often in Grand Tours in recent years, it's really been a formality for one particular rider, whether it be Nairo Quintana or maybe
Another young rider.
We've seen some real sort of cakewalks, haven't we, in white jersey competitions. But it should be interesting. And again, Rich, I'll say it again. I think it could have a massive bearing on the general classification because, you know, they're three strong teams, Quickstep, and Cannondale. I mean, they are still sort of freelancing their riders. I spoke to Joe Dombrowski yesterday about whether he was being asked to work for Formula. He said not really. He's pretty much got carte blanche. But then you've got Orica, who are definitely fully behind Adam Yates. So you've got three teams who, you know, might be able to help out, isn't it? Can really help out Tom Dumoulin, I think, in certain circumstances. It would be great if tomorrow, from Tom Dumoulin's point of view, one of those white jersey contenders got away in some kind of break, therefore forcing the other two teams to work.
Yeah, I mean, Cannondale have got their stage win now, and yet we're hunting for another one today with Dombrowski and Villela up in the break, and that was clearly their main aim today. But they've got a rider Formula who's there, and it's not going to be so easy for him to get in a break for that very reason. They could put some of their resources into helping him perhaps, but how would they do that when you've got Adam Yates, who has clawed his way back from that deficit and is clearly going pretty well? So Formula One Yates in a time trial, who's gonna be better there? Formula, maybe.
Well, Jungles is gonna.
Jungles, yeah, clearly. Jungles. But Jungles could lose about 3 minutes today.
I mean, I think
he could lose more time the next couple of days.
As I said, my favourite's Yates.
Okay, you'll stick with that.
But tomorrow, I mean, partly because tomorrow's finish is incredibly hard. It's kind of been lost in this succession, this sequence of incredibly hard stages and the sort of blockbuster climbs of Stelvio, the Mortirolo. I mean, it was the easy side of the Mortirolo, but still, the name is very famous. And then today's stage was described as the Queen stage, it was the big Dolomite stage. And people have sort of ignored tomorrow. The stomach finish at Piancavallo might be the most damaging, might be the most punitive of all of the climbs on this Giro because it's very, very long. It comes at the end of the stage, it comes at the end of the third week. There was a huge battle between my hero, Pavel Tonkov, and Marco Pantani there
in
1998, won by Tonkov, who we saw yesterday. Or two days ago. I was too starstruck.
You melted.
I would approach any rider, but I'm too starstruck when I see Pavel.
Yeah, it was incredible. I've never seen you like that.
I know. I was tiptoeing around him, wasn't I?
Wow.
Anyway, maybe tomorrow if he's at the finish, hopefully. So tomorrow, I think we'll see a big sort out between the white jersey contenders, Rich. And then, of course, we've got the difficult stage. What's going to be really intriguing about Sunday stage to Asiago?
Saturday.
Saturday stage to Asiago, I think it's going to be the valley between Monte Grappa and the start of the climb to Asiago. And it's a fair old distance between the two. And we could see, you know, we talked the other day about how maybe Movistar should be focusing more on the valleys than the climbs. That's the perfect place to do it.
Okay, well, let's wrap things up for tonight. A little reminder that Kilometre Zero, most recent one came out yesterday. That was called the Sufferfest, Surviving the Giro Mountains. Interviews with riders about what they do to just get through the pain of climbing these long passes. We hear a lot of Bram Tankink in there, who's great talking about this. We hear a bit of Sven Tuft. We hear Chris Juul-Jensen and a few other riders as well. Good story from Fabrizio Guidi about, well, have a listen, you'll hear it. So that came out on Wednesday, our final Kilometre Zero of this Giro, supported by Allpress Espresso. A new sponsor for us, very grateful indeed to them. Thank you very much. Our final Kilometre Zero will be the story of Michael Woods, a rider who had a big impact on Pierre Roland's stage when he was in that breakaway, marking a lot of moves. Only came into the World Tour last year, age 29. He's one of the oldest debutants in a Grand Tour. This is his first Grand Tour. Looks like he's going to finish it and finish it strongly. And he's a former runner, and the final Kilometre Zero is his story. And it's fascinating, and he's a very, very good talker and an interesting guy. So that'll be out tomorrow morning, and we'll be back tomorrow evening to wrap up the stage tomorrow. Hopefully it'll be another thriller.
Boom.
Thank you very much, Daniel.
Thank you, Richard.
A reminder that you can watch the Giro d'Italia live and exclusive on Eurosport and Eurosport Player. UK viewers can also watch highlights of each stage at 10 p.m. on free-to-air channel Quest.
There's a special offer for the Eurosport player, £29.99 for an all-access pass for the rest of 2017. Details of availability, compatible devices and full terms and conditions can be found on the Eurosport player website, uk.eurosportplayer.com. You've been listening to the Cycling Podcast in association with RAFA. Thanks to them and thanks to our other sponsors, Science and Sport and Maserati, and to All Press Espresso for supporting our morning show, Kilometre Zero. The music in this episode is by Amara Terra. Thanks to them. Thanks to those who help keep us on the road, in particular David Luxon, Jonathan Rowe, Nick Christian and Simon Gill. And thanks to Matt Field, who produced this episode.